Afternoon, everybody. We're going to begin our meeting this afternoon of the House Committee on Judiciary. I want to thank all of you for being here and hope you had a good weekend. Friday at some point, I haven't had a chance to talk to many of you. I'd be interested in your reactions to the program on Friday at some point as well. It'd be a helpful discussion, I think. We are initially going to do some measure introductions.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Council.
Chair, members of the committee, you have before you LC 1284, modifies law governing liability of individual tort feasors when more than one tort feasor is liable for injury, death, or property damage, eliminates reallocation of liability between tort feasors when court determines that all or part of the tort feasor's share of obligation is uncollectible. LC 1285 provides that expert witnesses may testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge if testimony is based on sufficient facts and data, if the testimony is product of reliable principles and methods, and if witness has applied principles and methods reliable to facts or data on which testimony is based. LC 1286 requires disclosure of expert witness in civil actions, requires written report on testimony of witness, qualifications of witness, and compensation of witness, prohibits use of expert witness at trial if disclosure not made, prohibits deposition of expert witness except for purpose of showing failure to comply with the disclosure requirements. LC 1287 limits contingency permitted in negligence claims against certain health professionals, authorizes court to further limit attorney's fees under contingency agreements and actions based on those claims. LC 1288 requires trier of fact to deduct collateral benefits from award of damages made on certain medical malpractice claims, specifies exceptions, prohibits payer of collateral benefits from seeking repayment from plaintiff, defendant, and certain other persons. LC 1289 modifies laws relating to comparative negligence, provides that for purposes of determining percentage of fault for each defendant, trier of fact may consider fault a person who is not subject to jurisdiction of court and fault a person who is not subject to action because claim is barred by statute of limitations or statute of ultimate repose. Allows defendant action to elect to withdraw consideration of fault a person who settled with claimant, provides that if fault a person is withdrawn from consideration, defendant need not establish fault a person in court must reduce total amount of damages awarded in action by amounts paid to the person in settlement. LC 1290 sets rate of interest on judgments and civil action relating to professional negligence as a person's licensed by Board of Medical Examiners, Oregon State Board of Nursing to a lesser 5% per annum or 3% in excess of discount rate.
Okay, colleagues, as is our normal procedure for introduction of committee bills, your assent to the introduction of these bills as committee bills in no way implies your support of the measure or the future of the measure as to whether it A, will be assigned to this committee, or B, whether it will get a hearing or be acted upon. It is purely a courtesy introduction of committee bills. Obviously, this is an issue that we've all heard quite a bit about in advance of the session and as the session has gotten underway. So in some form or another, I think that we'll be having a discussion about medical liability issues, and I think this is the first package of probably a series of packages of bills that will be introduced to aid us in that discussion. So with that, the chair would move introduction of LC 1284, 1285, 1286, 1287, 1288, 1289, and 1290 for introduction as committee bills. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
just for the record, can we just say who was the requester for these fine pieces of legislation?
I believe these bills will show as the requester at least the Oregon Medical Association and maybe others. Let's see. And the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bills are introduced. Council Taylor is reminding me to remind you that on Friday, January 31st, we are going to take another committee field trip. I know Fridays aren't always the best for everybody, and it violates our initial proposal to try to not have meetings on Friday afternoon. And this isn't a real meeting. It's a sort of a real meeting. But this is a field trip to the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility located in Woodburn. They'll be providing transportation for us to and from the Capitol, or for some of you who live north, if you want to drive and then not have to come back to the Capitol, that can be arranged too. Again, colleagues, I just encourage you to try to do this. I think it is much it's very worthwhile when we're talking about the impacts on these institutions, as we're going to be setting some of the policies we're going to have to set and in dealing with the budget issues, to have been there on the ground. We don't know exactly the departure time yet, Representative Barker. We will know that and get that information to you, but just sort of plan afternoon departure is what I'm thinking.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Przanski.
Do you know if we're going to have another one down to the Albany facility, the youth facility that's in Albany?
I don't think we're probably planning on a separate trip to Albany at this point. We could certainly arrange that, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Brazil mentioned that in her email to me, but it may be difficult to go from McLaren down to Albany.
And one day, I understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was hoping maybe one day that we could have that as an option, because since it's a newer facility, and some of us have had the opportunity to go through McLaren.
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt for a second that any individual member of the committee that would like to take a tour of any of these facilities, the department would be willing to adjust their schedules and make that available to you. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn on their behalf when I suggest that.
Thank you.
Anything further? If not, we're going to move on to the next part of the meeting. And this is informational, colleagues, because of the way the statutes work with respect to the Council on Court Procedures and the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. But we have with us today Ralph Spooner, who is the current chair of the Council on Court Procedures, and he's going to walk us through some brief information on what the Council on Court Procedures is recommending for changes to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. So, Mr. Spooner, if you'd come forward.
Thank you. And I have Maury Holland, Executive Director.
Great. It's always good to see Maury. Welcome back to the committee, Maury.
Thank you. All of you should have a packet in front of you with the rules as proposed. Each rule separately stated, and they were published in the Oregon Appellate Court advance sheets as required by statute. What I'd like to do this afternoon is just briefly run through each rule, and if you have any questions, I will be happy to try to answer them, or Maury will also. First rule that we're dealing with this year is ORCP 34B. It's kind of a technical amendment, but it's designed to eliminate a potential trap for claimants against decedent's estates if personal representatives or successors in interest fail to give a claimant the required notice within 1 year of a decedent's death. It was brought to the attention of the council by the plaintiff's bar, certainly the Professional Liability Fund of the Oregon State Bar has interest in this as well. But the idea here is to require the party where the death is involved to give notice to the plaintiff's lawyer so the plaintiff's lawyer can then file the appropriate paperwork with the court. Are there any questions on that one?
Any questions?
Right, I'll move on to the
All
next
right.
then. The next one is ORCP 43B, which is a discovery a rule. And this one is really designed to do a couple of things. Under our current rules, there's no provision for a continuing request for production. So in any type of a case, either party can serve a request for production on another party. But under the current rule, the party only needs to respond to that request as stated. The federal rules allow for continuing requests, so this would eliminate the need to file multiple requests for production in order to get discovery on an ongoing basis during the course of litigation. It's going to save time and money for the courts. This was supported by most of the members of the Council on Court Procedure, both the plaintiffs' bar, defense bar, and the judges. It will eliminate the need for multiple filings. It will eliminate the need for court hearings on motions to compel where there's an issue about whether someone did or did not comply with a request for production. Are there any questions on that rule?
Yes, Representative Barker.
If I may just clarify that. So then you ask for discovery in a case once, and that's all you need to do, and then they need to come forth with all the material.
Yes, that's the concept. And within the body of the request, we contemplate, as some practitioners are doing now, they put in, this is a continuing request. Then what happens is the other party under the current rule will object and say, it isn't provided for in the ORCP. So we're trying to eliminate this gamesmanship back and forth. So there's a duty to continuously respond to a request for production throughout the litigation.
Thank you.
And Mr. Spooner's description of the practice is exactly that. Almost everybody sends continuing requests out in their requests and then objects to them when they receive them because it isn't provided for by rule. So it's an appropriate change.
Any other questions? All right, I'll move on to ORCP 47C. This was suggested by Judge Barron, a trial judge down in Coos County, supported by both the bench and bar. It was to increase the number of days before the date set for trial in which a motion for summary judgment can be filed. The current rule allows for 45 days before trial. This will move it out to 60 days before trial. The thought there was that too many of these come too late, and the courts, of course, are trying to minimize scheduling trials that are otherwise going to be unnecessary, or the length of the trial might be affected by a summary judgment. We have partial summary judgments which can cut out some issues in the case. So the judges and the bar thought moving this back a little bit would allow for better use of our trial resources. As far as the courts are concerned, any questions on that,
Mr. Spooner? Was there much controversy on that one, or was that one? Did that one come?
There was initial discussion on it by the counsel. Mainly, the trial bar had some concerns about whether they would have all their discovery by that date to allow for the filing of the motion. But on reflection, I think the point that Judge Barron made and convincingly was that why should we get so close to a trial and then decide a summary judgment in favor of a party and then cancel a trial that's been scheduled? It doesn't affect him quite as much, I don't imagine, in Coos County, but certainly in Marion County where I practice, or Multnomah County, where they have lots and lots of trials scheduled, it'd be better to know further out that that trial is or is not going forward. So that's, and it was supported after there was further discussion without much debate. So
perhaps you or Mr. Holland can comment on how the rule changes the effective date for current cases. In other words, you got a case currently pending. You've got a trial date set out there. At what point does the 45-day to 60-day shift happen, and how are we accommodating people who, when it becomes effective, might be somewhere in the middle?
Well, I think the answer is probably one of those. I think prospectively would be the answer as opposed to retroactively, since it is a procedural change as opposed to a substantive change. One could argue it could be retroactive, but I think the application of the rule.
May I just say that, as with all of the ORCP amendments that have been promulgated, unless the legislature takes action to disallow them, they become effective on January 1st of 2004.
Right.
And then there is a rule, I don't remember the number of it, but there is a rule somewhere in Rule 1, a provision in the ORCP itself, that deals with the question of an action pending somewhere in the system, maybe in the trial court, and the 1st of January arrives, and does the judge and the parties operate under the amended provision or the existing or previous position? And that provision of the ORCP allows the judge to make a flexible decision based on the equities. of the situation. So I don't think any judge would say it's been 45 days, but now it's 60, and it's too late.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Crummell, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to Rule 43, and I may be mixing apples and oranges here, but with Rule 43 and Rule 47, are these two different topics, so the number of days does not matter?
They are two different topics, and they certainly interrelate. If you have a party wishes to file a summary judgment, they're going to need the information. So 43 would require an ongoing duty to disclose information as it's received in a seasonable fashion. 47 simply deals with a deadline within which a motion for summary judgment would need to be filed before a trial. And it's moving it back, but I think if you blend these two rules together, you're going to have an ongoing request, so moving the date back isn't going to make it any tougher to get it done, assuming you get your discovery, which is required under this change to impose an ongoing duty. Whereas before, you'd file request for production number one, then you might wait and reissue it in 60 days, 90 days, to see if the other side had new information. We're not going to need to do that if 43 is adopted as it's currently set forth.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
So 45 days in 43... versus 60 days, there's not a need for, even in the case of summary judgment, in either case, there's not a need for consistency in the number of days.
No, isn't.
Okay.
No. One is just a timing issue before trial, the 47 change.
Okay.
And it's really for the convenience of the trial judges. That's why that's happening. I mean, if you left it up to lawyers, they wait until the very last hour to get things done. And the judges are trying to push this date back a little bit so they can plan their schedules better.
Representative Ackerman, you had a question?
No.
Okay. All right.
The next two I'm going to just discuss briefly together. They're 44 and 55. In 1996, the federal government enacted the Health Insurance Accountability Act, and our rules have not been in conformance with that act. We've had an ongoing committee that's gone through actually three successive biennia working on this problem. There's big issues involving the plaintiff's bar and the defendant's bar as to what will be disclosed and how it will be disclosed, but I'm happy to report that we have had a joint committee working for the last two sessions of the Oregon Rules or the Council on Court Procedures working together. The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association appointed members that were approved by the chair, and the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel did likewise. So this is a joint effort, and I just want to point that out to you. If somebody thinks one side or the other may be gaining an advantage here, and Mr.
The OMA and the, and the hospital association.
Yeah. Yeah, we also, Maury just pointed out, the OMA and the hospital association also participated on the subcommittee that did this. So we've had input, and not just input, but hard work on the part of all those that would be affected by this. There's still more work that needs to be done on these rules, but what we're trying to do is bring them in conformance with the HIPAA regulations. And the changes that are there will do that, and they passed unanimously in the council. So that's something that needs to be done to keep our rules in conformance with the federal law. And this is, like I said, the beginning of some changes that will take place on how medical records are disclosed what the court's role is in deciding disputes where there's an issue about what should be disclosed. I don't there's any questions on that, but that's a significant piece of work that we've worked on for since I've been on the council, three sessions now.
Yeah, and it's occasionally spilled over here. I use this very point is probably one of the best examples of why an operating council on core procedures is extremely important. If they weren't pulling together the various interest groups with the courts, the judges, the lawyers who practice in this area, these fights essentially would find their way in front of this committee. And so as the keepers of the rules, it's an extremely important function. And this is a prime example of one that's been long and ongoing, and we've been able to sort of keep out of it while the interest groups have been able to do the work necessary to get our rule back into shape. So I think it's an excellent example of the work, and I commend the council for all the effort they've put into this over the last three terms. Are there questions? Specifically, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. I believe that it's the Patriot Act of 2001 that also identifies some privacy issues. Is that going? Will this also mesh with those new federal statutes, or is there yet again something that you'll have to go back and work on, and maybe the privacy parts of it don't affect the HIPAA requirements, but I'm just curious as to how that's all going to sort of fit together.
I think we need more work to just answer the question directly, but that this, what we've done in the rule changes here, will still be in conformance, because the blueprint for all of this has been the concept of the federal law now is much more restrictive in what a party can get in litigation,
right.
More restrictive than our current rules. But what this allows for is it preserves the law of privilege under Oregon law so that the party, the injured party and their counsel has an opportunity to object, whether their basis is this other federal legislation or not. There's a mechanism by which they can object. And then there's a mechanism by which, notwithstanding the objection, they still have a continuing duty to provide the records. And the way we do that in the real world is if there's a record that I object to on behalf of my client, say it's a drug record or a mental health record or something that has nothing to do with the litigation, then we prepare what's called a privilege log, and we identify the record that we have it. We object to producing it, and we state the reason why under the law of privilege under Oregon law. And then if the other party isn't satisfied with the privilege log, they can then raise that issue with the trial judge, who would then decide should that mental health record or drug record that the injured party thinks is unrelated, should it be produced or not. But this, the mechanism here preserves that, and then the question might be, would the lawyer raising the objection rely on the federal legislation you just mentioned or some other legislation, whether it be state or federal, to support the claim of privilege. So I think it's there, but I can tell you I was on the committee 2 years ago, and it is tedious work trying to make these things mesh. And the efforts of, as I said, both the we wrestled with it at the when I came on the council 3 years ago. They were wrestling with this, and we were trying to do it as a council. And I think most of you know, or if you don't, the council consists of 22 members, lawyers and judges that give up their Saturdays, one Saturday a month in the morning up at the bar office, and it's just too much work to do. So we appointed the last chair, Mick Alexander, appointed a subcommittee, and then this year I continued that subcommittee, sent letters out to the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar saying, help us. They brought in the OMA and the Hospital Association and had an interest. And the reason they have an interest, stop, but if you want to see how this all works together, doctor's offices would get multiple requests for production, and they're not set up to do this. So they'd say, well, we already answered that last month. Do we do it again? And so it's designed to cut down on how many copies are going to be produced and for whom. So I think it's a lot of hard work, and I think we've got a rule that'll work, but I'm here to tell you you'll hear about these rules in the future if you're still on this committee. So,
great, thanks.
The last two are just to change statutory references. They're little nit-nats to make sure they conform to the current statutory numbering. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any other questions,
Right. May I add something?
Yes, you may.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Spooner, I think, just forgot about something that the council did that was a little unusual for it, that is, and yet may be very important, and that is a suggestion came to the council early in the biennium from one or more practitioners about the fact that rather than the old-fashioned affidavit, do you want to explain it?
You want to go
ahead. Okay. Increasingly, in some other jurisdictions, something simpler is coming to use, and that is called a declaration. And it was suggested that the ORCP might be amended to permit the option, instead of an affidavit that has to be notarized by a notary, of a declaration. That, however, required amendment to the perjury statutes. And, of course, that statutory amendments are beyond the council's mission. So we worked with the bar, the Practice Procedure Committee of the bar, and with them developed the suggested amendments to the perjury statutes, which the legislature this session will be considering, will be coming before probably this committee at some point.
Morey, I think the good news is that it came before us on Thursday.
Oh.
At least the ORCP piece.
And I think, Bill, we passed it out, didn't we?
I think we did.
Yeah.
Well.
So we moved the declaration change out, knowing that it had the stamp. I think we had which judge from the who sits on the council happened to be here?
Carson.
Yeah. Yeah, he was here and came forward and talked to us a little bit about it as well. So it's on its way.
Good.
In fact, Representative Barker may be contacting you because he's the designated carrier of that bill.
Oh.
So
if
he's looking for help on his floor speech, he may want to give you a call.
Well,
morning.
It put me in a wonderful position, Mr. Chairman, that, of sitting there one evening with the statutes and redrafting the criminal statutes on the back of an envelope.
Well, that's funny. That's how we do it.
But, of course, merely to send it over to the committee for them to work on, which they did. And the reason it's, I think, worth mentioning is that the council is alert to the need for coordination and collaboration with other components of the process, including the bar and, in fact, all kinds of people that have an interest in this whole matter. And we're not monastic or at all inaccessible.
Well, thanks very much, and we do appreciate the work that the council does. It's important. I think sometimes it's lost; its importance is lost on people who don't understand how these procedural rules actually affect day-to-day operations in the court. And if you weren't doing it, somebody else would have to, and we appreciate your efforts. Yes, Mr. Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if either of the presenters were aware that House Bill 2049 is in the works, which would move or actually create a date for the last day to amend to add punitive damages. Right now the bill is setting that date at the old motion for summary judgment deadline of 45 days before trial, and I wonder if they had discussed or had any comment on if that bill did come before the committee. Obviously, we'd probably want to tag it to the new date for motions for summary judgment and make it 60 days before trial. I don't know whether that discussion at all came up in your meetings.
It did not, but it makes sense. If you look at the reason why judges want to move the summary judgment back, the same reason would apply to an amendment to add punitive damages.
Right. We'll certainly. I think that's something that had escaped my notice until just today, and so that's something that we'll monitor as it comes through as that new date is. Just for your information, again, colleagues, to understand how this works, the council by statute has the authority to modify these rules, and if the legislature takes no action, these rules then effectively change automatically and become effective on January 1st of the next year. So this doesn't require us to take any action unless there was action we wanted to take that was different than what the council was recommending. Otherwise, it just becomes law automatically with this rule change. So that's the procedure, and they're here today simply to advise us and give us the due diligence opportunity to look at these rules and see if there was anything else we wanted to do differently, which seems unlikely given the nature of these changes, in my opinion. Anything else? Yes, yes.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on counsel's question or inquiry about the punitive damages. I think that procedure is set by statute, so we in our wisdom can tinker with that, and we'll probably do a bad job. I would like to recommend that perhaps the council would consider making that an ORCP and looking at it a little more definitively, because I think there's some dispute within the bench and the bars whether what type of a hearing you have to produce your prima facie case on punitive damages so you can amend your complaint. I've had some judges say they require a full hearing, like a mini trial, and others will take affidavits or declarations consistent with summary judgment process. But we're sort of in limbo on that one in the practice, and I think that might be something that would be better suited for your counsel than for legislative tinkering.
Okay, we made note of that.
Thank you. Great. Anything further? Thank you very much, Maureen and Mr. Spooner. Appreciate your time. Okay, we're going to move to the next order of business, colleagues, which is...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative...
Just a real quick question with regards to logistics more than anything else. So if there was something in here that a member of the assembly thought should be raised and acted upon by the body, by the legislature, what would be the process? Would it be to have a bill drafted that basically directs the council in terms of changes to be made in the ORCP?
Yeah, my recollection, and I don't know that I know the exact answer, but I think my recollection is that you would draft a bill that looked different than this change, and we don't. We give them most of the control, but we do occasionally have bills where we change the rules of civil procedure without the involvement of the council, and that does occur. I have not ever been in a session where we took their recommended changes and did something different. I'm not sure that that's happened. Perhaps Maury knows, being the,
Mr. Chair,
the institutional memory.
No, that hasn't happened, but I just wanted to remind the Chair and the members that the council has, as largely as a result of Senator Bryan a few years ago and when you were council, has something called the Legislative Advisory Committee.
Right.
And if going through the ORCP amendments, a question arises in anyone's mind, any legislator's, on the merits of whether it's a good or a bad idea or whether it's going to cause problems with statutes or any of those sorts of things, that's what the Legislative Advisory Committee is in existence for. Mr. Spooner is a member, and there are others. And we can respond to requests for our views, for whatever they may be worth, virtually on a dime.
And that would certainly be the first recommended, from the chair's position, the first recommended step would be to let the Legislative Advisory Committee of the council participate in that discussion. But procedurally, Representative Crummell, I do think it probably requires a bill introduction suggesting some other action that would be passed by the body. Now, I say that sort of based on recollection, and I'm not certain. So I can what I'll ask is for counsel, Mr. Joseph, to look into your question and give you a specific response. Is that satisfactory?
That's fine. I was just curious, and I'm not planning on anything, so it's not a.
You're not sending up a red flag.
No, I'm not sending up a red flag. But my other question is, are all the members of the assembly then being provided a copy of this, or is there an email being sent to them that says, go to this website to review the rule ORCP amendments?
Representative Crummell, again, I think by statute they're obligated to provide the leadership of both chambers with a report. So the Senate President's office and the Speaker's office receive a report of the actions from the council, and as a matter of practice, although I don't think it's required, they provide the judiciary chairs with the same information, and that's why we took the liberty of inviting them to come in and present to the committee today, although I don't think it's necessarily required. I think it's positive common practice. So the leadership of both chambers has this information. I don't believe it goes out to the individual members unless someone wants to ask for it.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2110. And while counsel is introducing the nature of the bill, we'll ask Ronell Schenkel from the Department of Justice to come forward.
Chair, members of the committee, all these bills today come from me from the our Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, and what House Bill 2110 does, a series of things. It allows the child support program to suspend enforcement of support orders due to a change of physical custody of the child when a motion has been filed to terminate, vacate, or set aside a support or to modify the support order. It allows the court administrator to grant an exception to income withholding when there is a proof of timely payment. Allows the entity issuing an order to withhold unemployment compensation to convert the monthly support obligation amount to a percentage to be withheld for each benefit payment. Requires a moving party a modification to serve the non-requesting party in person or by certified mail, return receipt requested and services party, etc. Requires a parent initiating a proceedings under paternity proceedings with a child support right of one of the parents that the child has been assigned to the state to serve the child support program.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Schenkel, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. And as Mr. Taylor just indicated in his summary, this bill has nine sections that basically cover eight different amendments or proposed amendments to the law, which we are calling housekeeping for our child support laws. We've arranged these topics under two categories. One would be simple or minor law adjustments, and then the second category would be actual language and technical adjustments. And I thought I would briefly walk you through the changes in process and then take the guidance of the committee as to whether or not you want to go through the full language adjustments as well. So for the process adjustments, I would have you begin in Section 2, which amends ORS 25-125. That has to do with the law that allows the child support program to temporarily suspend our enforcement remedies or our enforcement services during the pendency of certain legal actions, such as terminations or modification to zero, based on a change of custody. In other words, if we are in a legal process and the child has changed custody and we know that the continuing enforcement of the original order may result in a credit balance, we temporarily stop enforcing until we get through the legal action, and then we resume with the correct amount. We're asking that we broaden this to allow that temporary suspension during any modification involving a custody change, not just modifications to zero, but perhaps it would be a modification where one party was paying, dad was paying mom, and now mom will be paying dad. I would then direct you to Section 4, which is suggesting an amendment to 25396 that has to do with exceptions to income withholding. Currently in the law, you will see that in order to qualify for one of these exceptions to income withholding, which allows the party to pay through electronic funds transfer, they must bring their case current first. During the normal pendency of a legal action, it can take a few months simply to get through that process. And the result of a modification sometimes will place that case into an arrears balance simply because of the time it takes to go through a modification process. In those scenarios, we would like to have the law broad enough that those obligors could still qualify for the exception and set up electronic funds transfer to pay both their monthly obligation and something towards arrears. We then have you look at Section 5, which proposes an amendment to ORS 25414 that has to do with income withholding for child support on unemployment compensation. And without taking you through an actual withholding computation, I would start by saying briefly it allows us to work with Employment Department to withhold a percentage of the weekly UC benefits that are being paid, which comes out better both for the collection of child support but also for the person that we're collecting from than a typical income withholding calculation would allow. Section 7 strives to amend ORS 416-425 that has to do with service during a modification. The language in the statute is simply outdated and has been missed in previous sections, and we believe that the intent and the appropriate legal process would be to serve the non-requesting party, the person who did not ask for the modification by personal service or certified mail, and the requesting party by the lower standard. The intent, obviously, is to make sure that people are aware of the legal action that is pending on their case. The remaining sections are mostly adjustments to language and technical clarification types of things. Chair Williams, would you like me to walk through those as well?
Sure.
Okay. Backing up to Section 1, you will notice that we are simply removing the reference to Chapter 110 found currently in ORS 25010. That is because Chapter 110 is the adoption of the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. It has its own set of definitions, which are separate from the definitions in Chapter 25. Moving on to Section 3, we are seeking to amend ORS 25372. You will see in the existing law there's a long string of statutory sites in there. We believe, and Legislative Council believes, those were originally put in when we first, or you first, enacted the income withholding laws in Oregon. It has become difficult for Legislative Council to keep up with those references, and they requested that we take them out and just leave the substantive portion of that law in place and get rid of all the cross-references. Jumping then to Section 6, we are seeking to amend ORS 109-103. Last session, you passed Senate Bill 337 for us. That was a bill that was attempting to clarify, not change, but clarify existing law with regard to when private parties and private practitioners need to serve a copy of a motion or petition on the child support program because the state may have an interest, and we simply missed the statute related to pro se litigants. So I want to put that same clarifying language into that section of the law. And then Sections 8 and 9 both touch on the same topic. We are removing one word, the word existing, from those statutes. They both relate to the assignment of rights when a child is either in foster care with DHS or juvenile care with Oregon Youth Authority. And the intent, we believe, of the law is to have the rights to child support assigned over to the state, but that one word in some specific case scenarios hangs us up. So those are the requested amendments in our housekeeping bill. Additionally, I might note for the record that in working with various partners, we have some amended language that we would like to propose to this bill, and today I received some additional comments with from the Judicial Department that we would like the opportunity to work with them on making a few more minor adjustments.
And, Ronell, just so I understand, along with your testimony, there was passed out a proposed amendment to House Bill 2110. Yeah, that's, I guess, the way you'd say that, isn't it? But those aren't complete. Is that what you're suggesting?
Chair Williams, that's correct. These amendments were based on the comments we had received from partners to date. I just received some additional comments this afternoon.
Okay. All right. Are there questions for Ms. Schenkel about the proposed changes? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Schenkel. We've talked about these rules, and I'm in support of them. I'm just a little bit curious as to how things happen procedurally. And when a motion is filed to terminate or set aside support, your office would have the authority to suspend enforcement. Does this contemplate that you are served with the documents in the case and you exercise your discretion? Is that how it works?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, this contemplates that we are actually facilitating that legal action, that modification, and enforcing the case at the same time. You could also be in the scenario where I suppose the parties are before the circuit court on a private action, but we are providing child support enforcement services, and we would have or would like to have the discretion in either of those scenarios in order to avoid a credit balance situation to temporarily suspend enforcement. The assumption is that we would only do that if no one objects.
Okay, then that's my second question is when the party objects and says, no, the child is really with me, he's not with the paying party, then suspension, the administrator may not suspend enforcement. I guess my question is, there's no factual determination there, is there, as to whether where the child really is? You're just saying, oh, if there's an objection, we will not suspend enforcement. Should there be a fact-finding process there?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, you are correct in your reading that we simply take this action or cease to take this action based on information from the parties and not necessarily detailed fact-finding. We accept any claim of physical custody changes from either of the parties and will initiate a legal action based on that. And depending on the objections, we would obtain further discovery as needed. But in some cases, there is a contest. In other cases, there are not. And so we do not have a specific statutory reference to what that discovery might be.
Okay, it just seems to me then once the objection is made, then you can't suspend enforcement and the case proceeds and the hearings officer or the judge will sort it out.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, there are two actions going on during this time. And there may be two different objections. We have a legal action pending, a modification of some sort, and there may be an objection to that, you're correct, and perhaps an administrative hearing pending on the matter of the order itself and the provisions within that order. Then we have that second question of, does it seem appropriate to temporarily suspend our enforcement remedies? For instance, should we temporarily stop the income withholding because it looks like the case might go into a credit balance, and we may then have an overpayment to one of the parents that we need to deal with? In that scenario, we would propose to suspend. We would send a separate notice out to the party saying, it looks like this is what is playing out on this case. We're suggesting that we temporarily stop enforcement until the final order. But as long as that custodial parent says, no, I want you to keep enforcing, then we continue to do so, and we deal with that when we get the final order with whatever remedies we have available depending on the outcome. And we may, in fact, be in a credit balance scenario at that point and need to take appropriate action.
I guess my point is giving that parent just the right to object prohibiting enforcement defeats the purpose of your rule, doesn't it?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, it only allows us to do less work in those scenarios where the mother and father do agree that it's going to result in a modified order and it may result in a credit balance, but it certainly does not remedy all scenarios. You're correct.
Okay. No, I'm convinced you need the authority in a majority of the cases. I just want to see how the process works. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Further questions? Hearing none, why don't you stay put, Ronell, and we'll call Lane Barlow to come forward from the Oregon Men's Association. Lane, it's good to see you again, and you listed that you were both for and against this bill, so I assume there are parts that you agree with and parts that you might not.
For the record, Lane Barlow, Oregon Men's Association. Yeah, we like some of it, and we intensely dislike some of the rest of it. In section 2, if I can call your attention to page 3, lines 23 to 35 of the bill, what we really object to here is the state proposes to remove a court or a hearings officer's ability to zero out a support order. There are other reasons to zero out a support order besides change of custody. One of those is death. President of Oregon Men's Association had a brother who was actually murdered in California a few years ago, and before his widowed mother died last year, she was hounded by the child support authorities in California to pay off his child support debt. We don't need that kind of a situation to happen here. There are other amendments we would probably bring in at a later date. Right now, I'm just going to touch on a few of the things that we have a problem with. At the bottom of our testimony, we talk about Section 7. In Section 7, it's proposed that when one party in a modification procedure is going to start the modification, that they send the notice by first-class mail to the other party. One of the hardest things to prove is whether somebody mailed you something or not. We would highly recommend that there be some proof of mailing required in any modification proceeding, particularly in 107-135. It is required that service of the modification notice has to be according to the rules of summons, which means personal service, certified mail with return receipt requested, and that's only in rare circumstances and so forth. Let's avoid a lot of mischief, and let's require proof of service here. Other than that, that's the end of our comments for this hearing.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. I just want to get clarification on the example you gave where apparently an obligor died and then the mother, who I assume from what you're saying was the trustee or over the estate.
There was no estate.
Okay. Are you taking a position if there is an estate and there's an outstanding debt that the estate should be not liable for the existing or what was existing in the way of debt to the for the child support?
Good point, Representative Przanski. And I think it's a point that a judge looking at this needs to have the ability to zero out a child support judgment in the case of a death or an inappropriate circumstance rather than second guessing. This bill proposes to remove zeroing out a judgment or an order unless there's a change of physical custody of the child.
Ronell, could you maybe explain the reason that the zero-out language in your proposal is removed?
Certainly. Chair Williams, the intent is absolutely the opposite of what Mr. Barlow is saying. We feel that the current language that says specifically a modification is zero is limiting. By taking that term out and saying anytime we're modifying a support order due to a custody change, we are in fact attempting to broaden the law. So we could in fact be working on a modification of zero in the future, but we could also be working on a modification where dad used to pay mom and now mom pays dad. We're trying to encompass a greater number of cases, not fewer. So taking out that language was an expansion.
So to make it clear on the record, you believe that even with that language, the hearings officer or the judge could take it to zero.
Chair Williams, that is correct. In fact, through our administrative process, if there was no objection, we could modify a prospective order to zero. It is only from that point forward, however, it does not go to doing anything about any established arrears.
Okay. Further questions of either Mr. Barlow or Ms. Schenkel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I think I'm having a minor problem with the statement that you just made, because you said that it's going to broaden it so it could be for other reasons than change of physical custody, but yet starting on line 23 through line 25, specifically it says when a motion has been filed to terminate, vacate, or set aside a support order or to modify a support order due to a change in physical custody of the child. I mean, that's the language that's in there. So to me, it would seem like it is limiting, because then the rest of the other language, starting on line 27, the order being terminated or modified to zero because of the obligor has physical custody of the child. And maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see anywhere else in there where it's allowing for a judge or a hearings officer to zero a balance based on other reasons.
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, I apologize if I misspoke. You are correct. The only type of modifications we're attempting to cover here in this temporary suspension of enforcement are modifications due to a custody change for the child. It is not broader. It is not all modification actions. You are absolutely correct. What I was attempting to say, however, was the proposed modification, the proposed order, could be one of several things. It could be a modification down to zero. It could be a modification to a new amount. It could be a modification for one parent to now pay the other. But it is limited to change of custody scenarios. You are correct.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So what happens if, as in the case that Mr. Barlow was just describing, an obligor dies and there's how does the child support go to zero? I mean, is that something then that the department will initiate, or is that up to the trustee of the estate to initiate, or is that something that's done at probate, or how does that occur?
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, as soon as it comes to the attention of the child support program that an obligated parent is deceased, oftentimes that is simply a phone call from a member of the family or the other party, we will take the appropriate action depending on that underlying order. In some instances, the death itself and some sort of evidence of the death is enough to stop the ongoing accrual under an order. And in some cases, we actually need to do a legal action to change that order. But basically, from the month that an obligor died and that point forward, we would be in some manner taking that obligated amount to zero. As Representative Prozanski pointed out, you may still have some arrears for a time prior to that that the program may continue to attempt to collect if there is some sort of estate.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair. So, if an obligor dies, and there are arrears, and if there either is no estate or the estate is insufficient to cover the arrears, then are other members of the family then expected to cover those arrears, or is that something that that the court takes into consideration and disposes of the arrears as well?
Chair Williams and Representative Krummel, we do not have the legal authority to pursue other members. We can only pursue that obligated parent named in the order or the assets of that person. We would not attempt to collect child support from other relatives or other sources.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Barker.
Mr. Bartle, on your objection to number 7, unless I'm reading something backwards there, I think what the state was asking to amend was that the mover, the person who is making the change, would have to notify the other person by registered mail return receipt request, not just by dropping it in the mailbox.
No, this is first class mail. The requesting party trying to move it.
Non-requesting party in person or by certified mail return receipt requested. And the service on the requesting party by first-class mail. The person wanting the change would have to notify the other one with registered mail return receipt requested so that you would know that the party was informed. Is that correct? I mean, am I?
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, you understand us correctly. We are, in fact, trying to remedy exactly what Mr. Barlow is speaking of in the current law.
Thank you.
In that case, never mind.
That's why we have these meetings, so we can all come to a perfect understanding.
I'm like you. I read too many of these bills, and they all run together. It's terrible.
Yeah, well, yeah, we know just how you feel, actually. And it's only been 2 weeks. Yes, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Schenkel, going back to page 3, lines 23 through 25 there, if we remove the bowl language due to a change in physical custody of the child, and the sentence read without that, which would even give you greater discretion, would that cause you concern? Would it be too broad, or would that reach the problem that Mr. Barlow is concerned about?
Chair Williams and Mr. Taylor, that would be very broad discretion, which we could then further flesh out in administrative rule, perhaps. We would anticipate a high number of objections, and it would probably be rare that we could use this temporarily suspended remedy in most cases other than a change of custody.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Okay, hearing none, we're not going to obviously go to work session because there are not amendments that have been drafted. I would encourage Ms. Schenkel, if you haven't already, to share your proposed amendments to the extent you know them with Mr. Barlow, and also to work with Council Taylor on getting amendments drafted so the bill can come back before the committee. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2110, open the public hearing on House Bill 2111, and if I remember correctly from my witness sign-up sheet, you two shouldn't go too far away. Ms. Schenkel, if you want to come back up and pass out your materials while Mr. Taylor briefs the committee. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2111, as you know, comes from the Support Enforcement Division of the Department of Justice, makes a decree or order a final judgment in the child support matter effective to the time the party is served with the motion rather than the back to the date of the motion itself.
Why don't we start with Ms. Schenkel, and then we'll have Mr. Barlow, and also Russ Lepetsky is here as well, if you want to come up, Russ. Russ, are you representing yourself today or the Oregon State Bar?
Just myself.
All right. You were sitting sort of close to Bob, so it was sort of hard to tell.
I try not to.
Go ahead.
For the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice, Division of Child Support. There are two primary areas seeking amendment in House Bill 2111. The first one is a federal mandate issue for the child support program, and we discovered it in researching early on some of our legislative proposals. The piece that we're looking at has to do with our federal regulations in 45 CFR 303.106, and I believe you have a copy of that attached to my testimony. But the legal interpretation that we have received on that regulation made it clear to us that the current statute, which allows us to have orders, modified orders, I should say, effective back to the date of motion or petition, is too broad, and in fact, that the federal regulation would instruct us to make the effective date of modification orders the date of service of the non-requesting party. In other words, if you initiate a motion and you go about serving the parties, the date the non-requesting party is served, and at that point everyone is aware that there is a modification pending, that would be the date that the court or the administrator could go back to related to the effective date of the new child support amount. The second provision that is in this bill is a customer service piece, in that currently in the judicial arena there is a remedy available to families that they can seek a credit against their child support arrears for a temporary physical custody change of the child. Today's family dynamics often result in mom and dad basically deciding to do something different for a month. They don't actually change their custody order. They don't actually seek a modification of the child support order because it's a temporary situation, but for whatever reason, the obligated parent ends up having the child in their household for a period of time. They don't file any satisfaction to reflect that action, and then later, when the obligor is looking at their account balance, they realize they were charged for that month and are seeking credit. Currently, the program directs those people into circuit court for this remedy. We are proposing in this bill that in those fact scenarios where the custody change was with the consent of the parties and everyone agrees it did happen and a credit should be allowed, that we would be able to do that through the administrative process. So those are the two key provisions found in this bill, the first one being a federal mandate issue for us that we believe we need to tighten up the law to bring our statutes into compliance with our child support regulations, and the second one being a customer service issue. On this bill, we also have, you'll see attached to your testimony from our department, some suggested amendments from partners. We have additional amendments being proposed that you'll hear from Mr. Lipetsky today, and then I am aware of some other language changes that we would like to discuss with the Judicial Department.
Mr. Barlow, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll open it up for, we'll have Mr. Lipetsky also talk, and then we'll just open it up for a discussion.
Thank you, Chair Williams. For the record, Lane Bartle, Oregon Men's Association. We absolutely endorse what the state is saying about smoothing out custody and the support procedure there. As the once father of teenagers, and they can really go back and forth, courts can't keep up with them. We've always consistently supported being able to handle these types of things administratively because administratively, they can move fairly fast and with very few technicalities. Excuse me. We do have a problem. If we go to page 3 and lines 17 to 22, the state is proposing that a final judgment becomes a final judgment, and that the support, the child support or the spousal support portion of that can never be changed. This is an absolute conflict with not only equity, but with Rule 71 of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. There are certain grounds when a final judgment can be set aside, among those being misrepresentation, fraud, and absolute misjustice. There's mistakes, inadvertent surprise, and so forth. This is the collateral attack rule in our civil procedures, and this is in conflict. The state is proposing that a mistake could be carved in stone, and that a judge or hearings officer does not have the discretion to change a mistake or a great injustice or a fraud. And we oppose that very much. We would suggest that the language that we put in this set-apart paragraph be added. If needed, I'll we'll put in a formal amendment.
Go ahead, Russ, if you want to make your comments, and we'll...
Sure. Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to domestic relations. I'm a past chair of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, but I'm not appearing today on behalf of the State Bar in any way. The problem that I'm seeking to address by amendment to the bill is one whereby a party who previously was paying child support but did not have custody of a child may acquire by court order custody of the child, and at the same time there may not be any sort of a court order which terminates that parent's prior support obligation that they had been paying at the time they did not have custody. Currently, the court does not have the authority to then down the road go back and retroactively modify that support obligation or terminate it retroactively unless the child goes and changes custody to the support obligor with the knowledge and the consent of the party that previously had custody. In a case where there is a contested custody hearing and the change of custody is pursuant to court order, it's not with the knowledge and consent of the former custodial parent because it's done by court order against that person's will. So the amendment that I propose, and I've handed out a one-page testimony with an amendment, simply says that the court has the discretion, not the obligation, but the discretion to go back and retroactively terminate a support obligation if the child is with the former obligor, either with the knowledge and consent of the support obligee or pursuant to court order. So we're adding, I'm suggesting that we add pursuant to court order language, which would encompass the situation where the court has actually changed physical custody, but for any number of reasons has not concurrently terminated that parent's prior support obligation. That's my proposal.
Okay. Let's open it up for questions. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Thank you. Russ, I just want to make sure that proposed language that you have, does that go in page 3 of the bill, lines 23 to 24?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, it goes a number of places.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't list them all because the bill has a number of different contexts in which support could be awarded that the identical change would need to be made.
Okay, so you're proposing it in every place where that formula
That's correct.
Occurs? Okay.
Further questions? I guess, Ronell, I'd like you to respond to both the issues raised by Mr. Barlow and the proposal made by Mr. Lepetsky.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, first of all, in response to Mr. Barlow's testimony, I guess my initial response would be that the language that you see indicated in our proposed changes to the law does not change the portion that I believe Wayne has issues with. All we're attempting to do is take existing statute related to the remedies available and change the effective date from the date of motion to the date of service. The language itself that exists about when and how you can modify, set aside, alter orders is not anything that we were attempting to change in this particular bill. With regard to Mr. Lepetsky's suggested amendment, I believe that the Judicial Department was considering looking at that same expansion of the remedy. What I would say is the program has not had time to look at this previously. It seems to be a policy issue that the committee certainly could choose to give the courts and the administrator greater flexibility in this arena than we currently have. The bill before you simply proposes to give the administrator the same current remedies that the courts have. This, as I understand it, would strive to broaden that for both of those forms, and that is certainly a policy decision that this committee may choose to make.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Just a follow-up. I mean, will the department take a position? I mean, I understand you're not asking for this broad of a change, but if you don't have it today, can you get back to us as to what the position would be?
Chair Williams and Representative Brzezinski, definitely. My anticipation would be we'd be neutral. That is certainly a remedy that you can provide to us. I would just want to make sure that there aren't some narrow scenarios where the state has an interest and we'd want to be involved before the court went back and changed an order.
Yes, counsel.
Mr. Lepesky, you mentioned you're not representing the family law section of the bar today, and I know you're its past chair about 3-4 years ago. What's your sense? Do you think that they would support your proposal, or would this be controversial with them, or what?
I think they would support it. I think they would support it. I have not talked to anyone about it. I didn't see this bill until this morning, which is why I didn't reach out to them and get some input. I know I've spoken to some people who handle a lot of juvenile law cases where this is also a problem, and as I indicated in the written testimony, in the juvenile court context, where you have the court may change custody on fairly short notice and not in the context of that juvenile proceeding concurrently do anything with a support obligation, which continues to tick away. I would anticipate the section would support the proposal, but I certainly have not spoken to the section about it.
Yes, Representative Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Russ, if your proposal doesn't also address Mr. Barlow's concern. I mean, if one of the grounds on which a court may set aside an order would be on the basis of grounds under ORCP 71, doesn't your language encompass his concerns as well?
To the extent that my proposal gives the court more discretion in more circumstances to retroactively terminate a support obligor's support obligation, I would think it would be consistent with Mr. Barlow's concerns in general, although I have not spoken to him about that. He should speak for himself.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Bob.
Well, it just seems like it. I guess if you can get a court order setting aside a judgment on the basis of fraud, let's say, for relief under ORCP 71, then it seems like you've got an order, a court order that works within your language that would constitute an exception for that.
I understand your point.
On setting aside.
Representative Shetterly, if I follow you, you're saying that if the court did in fact set aside a support order for fraud or extraordinary circumstances, that would be a court order that would fall within the plain
right.
face of the amendment.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about it in that context, but I suspect you're correct.
Anything further? Renell, you passed out again some small amendments for 2111 that I assume you want to bring forward. Are you anticipating additional amendments beyond anything contained in the conversations that just occurred here in front of the committee?
Chair Williams, yes, again, we would like the opportunity to speak with Judicial Department about some recent amendments that they proposed.
Okay. Then I would encourage you to discuss with both Mr. Lepesky and Mr. Barlow what you heard here today, and also work with Mr. Taylor, and we'll honor everybody's request for amendments, preferably ones that you can all agree on, and if not, separate requests, and we'll make a decision when we bring the bill back for work session. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2111, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2113. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2113 comes to you again from the Support Enforcement Division of the Department of Justice. Limits to a greater extent than current law now allows the disclosure of child support enforcement information. Clarifies the Support Enforcement Division is not prohibited from reporting child abuse by the provisions of this non-disclosure law. Requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules consistent with federal regulations governing confidential child support information.
And much to all of your surprise, our witnesses on this bill are Renell Shankle from the Department of Justice and Lane Barlow from the Oregon Men's Association. Ms. Shankle.
For the record, Renell Shankle with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. As Mr. Taylor just described to you, this bill is a bill that is pointed at the statute related to child support program information and the confidentiality of such information. This is another federal mandate bill for us in that the federal regulation that our current statute in Oregon is based on has been repealed, and that language that was fairly broad with regard to what other partner agencies we can share child support information with is gone. It leaves us with some remaining regulations that are much tighter. Basically, what we know is that those agencies that are entitled to still receive child support information from the program are the welfare Title IVA folks, as well as the Title 19 Medicaid, but not necessarily the broader list of all of the agencies who have been receiving information because they receive federal funding under the past regulation in our current statute. This regulation was repealed some time ago. It was not discovered in time for the 2001 legislative session. Since that date, we have been attempting to obtain from our federal government office information about what will replace that regulation, and to date they do not have an answer for us. So you will also see in our bill that we are proposing that you give the Child Support Program rulemaking authority. So if and when the federal government does issue a new regulation specific to child support information, we could reflect those instructions in our administrative rules and not necessarily need to come back time and again to amend this statute. This bill, we also have some proposed amendments specific to receiving information through the Federal Parent Locator Service, which is a federally mandated service that the Child Support Program provides, and so you have a copy of those proposed amendments before you. I'm not aware of any other comments from other partners or potential amendments at this time.
Okay, Mr. Barlow.
Thank you. For the record, Lane Bartle, Oregon Men's Association. We only have two concerns here. One of them is on page 2, lines 4 to 6, but particularly 4 and 5. It says the child support program may compare and share information with public and private private entities necessary to perform, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We'd like some clarification on what those private entities are, because if there's confidentiality, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Our other concern is the effect of the Federal Privacy Act of 1974. The use of a person's Social Security number, which I'm old enough, I used to have one of those too that said not to be used for purposes of identification. But there's a Federal Privacy Act of 1974, I believe is still in effect. If a person's Social Security number is used that violates their rights in any way, whoever violated the rights with the use of that Social Security number can be sued, and federal law guarantees a minimum of $1,000 to be given to that person, plus all their court costs, attorney fees, et cetera. That's all.
All right. Are there questions for Ms. Shankle or Mr. Barlow about their testimony? You want to respond to the Social Security issue, Ms. Shankle?
Chair Williams, if I understand Mr. Barlow's concern correctly, it would be about the release of the Social Security number, which is a piece of data that the Child Support Program does gather. We collect that information, and it is used under other statutes, specifically the statutes related to filing orders in court and certain statistical data that needs to be filed along with that record. We also, and this committee is aware of, have some enforcement remedies where we use Social Security numbers as secondary identifiers. One of those is a bill that you heard last week related to Social Security numbers and license suspension, where we use that in combination with name and date of birth to make sure we are targeting, so to speak, the correct person and do not inadvertently disrupt someone else's life. I don't know if that completely gets to Mr. Barlow's concerns, but those would be my initial comments.
What about the one where he referenced the private versus the public?
Yes, Chair Williams. His reference on page 2 to lines 4 and 5, the important language I believe there about the public and private entities would be that we share information only necessary to perform our program responsibilities. So an example of a private entity that comes to mind right now is legislation that was passed by this committee last session related to private collection agencies and their partnership with the Child Support Program on certain cases where, for purposes of those enforcement activities and with the consent of that obligee, there is certain information that we would release to a private collection agency who qualifies under that law. But it's specific to doing program business.
And there's a whole separate slew of responsibilities and then that they are then under to keep that information confidential.
Chair Williams, that is correct.
All right. Yes, counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Shankle, could you give us an example of what is now will be allowed to be released but will not be if this bill is passed?
Certainly, Chair Williams and Mr. Taylor. One of the common examples, I guess, if you will, that falls under the current statutory language about other programs that are federally funded would be the Housing Authority. It's a part, as I understand it, of their common practice that they want to find out whether or not a recipient is receiving regular child support payments, and they contact the program directly to get that accounting information. Accounting information is something that's held confidential to the parties of a case under normal circumstances, and so should this law pass, the Housing Authority would need to get the consent of that party before they could obtain accounting information from the program.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Crummell and then Representative Ackerman.
Thank you. first of all, when dealing with collection agencies, do you actually sign and enforce non-disclosure agreements with them?
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, the partnership that I mentioned is that is perhaps too broad of a statement. The program does not actually enter into contracts with those agencies, and therefore we don't actually have disclosure language specifically with them. What occurs briefly is a custodial parent decides that they want that added resource. The program, for whatever reason, hasn't gotten to complete enforcement on their case. They actually enter into a contract with a private collection agency. They then give us authority as the program to basically treat them as a person entitled to information on their case. And the information that we would release would be based on that parent's authority and to be used specifically for child support. But no, we don't specifically enter into agreements with those entities.
Okay. And then as the next part of that, if I may, Mr. Chair.
You may.
If the obligee asks for this collection agency or another agency to enter into the case, is the obligee authorized or able then to give information that would otherwise be held private by the obligor?
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, the obligee, of course, can give out any information that they have access to and direct knowledge to, but with regard to the program, we are not going to release anything to that private collection agency that we would not otherwise release to that party. So, for example, if there's not a legal action going on and we're simply enforcing a case, that obligee and therefore that private collection agency are not entitled to address information and certain other statistical pieces of information that they would be entitled to during a legal action. So we would treat the private collection agency the same way we treat that party. They would be entitled to the same type of information, or more specifically, and generally what they're looking for in that scenario is employment information so that they can attempt to take some sort of an enforcement remedy. But it's not broad authority to receive information on both parties, no.
In that case, and can the obligee be held responsible for providing what otherwise might be considered private information of the obligor if the obligor objects to the information being provided?
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, the program does not have any specific authority over the parties and any information that they have about one another and what they do with that information. This statute only guides what the program staff will do with our information, who we will share it with and who we will not. But we don't have any authority over the parties and what they do with the information.
So if an obligor were to call and say, gee, my ex-spouse gave information out about me that I consider to be private and everything, what recourse do I have? You're going to tell them to go fly a kite, or what are you going to tell them?
Chair Williams and Representative Crummell, we are not going to be able to assist them with any action against that party, and we most likely would advise that they may want to seek counsel from an attorney because we do not give specific advice to the parties.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay. Good. Now we'll see these back then after you've gotten a chance to get the amendments drafted, and you'll also confer again with Mr. Barlow about the issues that he raised. All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 13, and we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2114. And I know that this will come as a great shock to the members of the committee.
I know I'm surprised, Mr. Chair.
But our witnesses on this matter are Ronell Schenkel and Lane Barlow. Yeah, and counsel's going to introduce it for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2114, once again, comes from the Attorney General's Office Support Enforcement Division, allows a single writ of garnishment to be issued for two or more judgments for past due child support owed by the same judgment debtor, allows the Department of Human Resources to adopt rules governing distribution of the amounts received in a single writ and being distributed to multiple cases in multiple families.
Ronell.
For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support, and I'm happy to say this is not a federal mandate bill. What you have before you is simply an improved customer service proposal. It is very common for obligated parents to have multiple family units and therefore multiple child support cases that are being enforced by the program. It is also common that through our incredibly successful financial institution data match program where financial institutions regularly provide asset information to the child support program, and we are then able to issue administrative garnishments, that we may be issuing two or three garnishments against one obligor because they have two or three cases. The way that the law reads now is we send those three garnishments, let's say, out to the financial institution all at the same time. Whichever envelope that staff person picks up and opens first, they will apply funds to. If there are funds left, they will go to a second envelope, but if there are not, then the action is over. Our proposal would be that we still prepare those three complete garnishments, but that we be allowed specifically for child support garnishments to also issue a single writ, some sort of a cover perhaps that says, here is the total of the debts owed that we are attempting to garnish. Send us all funds up to this amount. And then according to our child support distribution rules, we will distribute among the cases. That is the remedy that we are seeking with this bill. And I will point out that there is one very minor amendment that we're proposing, and we've handed out to you. We would simply like to remove the term immediately because attorneys have already started arguing over what immediately might mean in the statute. That is the only amendment pending that I'm aware of.
Mr. Barlow.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lane Barlow, Oregon Men's Association. We waive testimony at this time.
Okay, good. No, Lane, I'm going to put you on the spot. I want to ask you, does that mean that you don't know whether you have a position on the bill or you don't think you oppose it?
We, our members have no opposition to this bill in its present form.
Okay.
At this time.
And that includes with the deletion of the word immediately as proposed by Ms. Schenkel?
We endorse that.
Yeah, okay. I see a couple of my old friends from the financial institutions sitting in the audience. You didn't sign up. Do we assume that that means you don't have any objection? I'm going to bring up Mr. Sherman from the Bankers Association. And the credit unions are indicating that they don't have any objection. Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Well, Mr. Sherman's coming, I guess maybe we'll hear, but of course you've been leading the brave charge through garnishments and judgments, and I know DOJ was participating in that. Did this come up in that, or is this coming up outside?
We call that the charge of the light brigade, Representative Sherrill.
You mean into the valley?
Yeah. Both Mr. Sherman and Ms. Schenkel have participated regularly, I think without fail, frankly, in those meetings on the garnishment statute. So I'm happy to let either one of them respond. But, Ken, why don't you go ahead and comment on the bank's position generally on the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr., and I represent the Oregon Bankers Association. And we have worked extensively through the interim on the issue of garnishment, both in this bill and another bill that I think has yet to come before you. And we did, in response to Representative Shetterly's question, we did consider this within the context of the work group. The Oregon Bankers Association supports this bill. We feel that it will expedite the process of handling these garnishments. And the only comment that I would make is I thought I heard Ronell say that there would be three writs of garnishment. And I, as I read the bill, it's really just going to be one writ. A single writ of garnishment would be issued. Is that correct? I mean, that's the language of the bill.
Chair Williams and Mr. Sherman, probably here I am, not an attorney, opening my mouth and getting in trouble again. We still intend to issue all of the paperwork necessary to constitute a garnishment and have some sort of a single cover type of document. So whether or not I use the term writ inappropriately, I will leave to you.
Well, I think what we read into this bill, and I think is intended, is a single writ that would name two or three judgments, and we think that's an improvement in the law. It will expedite handling this, and it will also cut down the cost to the state because with each writ they're now paying us garnishment search fee, and this will limit that to a single fee rather than multiple fees.
And I believe that is, I would agree with your description, Mr. Sherman, that it does provide for a single writ that lists multiple judgments and with all the benefits that you've described. Are there any other questions about this, colleagues? Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Thank you. I guess then on line 12 where it says separate debt calculation form for each of the judgments be prepared, and that's a statutory form. Will this require any change in that form if you're going to be putting three together at the same time? Do you calculate each of those independently of the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I don't believe it will require any change in the statutory form. It will just be a separate form that will be prepared for each of the judgments.
For each of the judgments. And I think that's what Ms. Schenkel was referring to, is the papers that fall behind this will still require the independent calculation, which if you were for some reason going to oppose this, you would want to see that each of those calculations were being done separately and independently so you could verify their correctness. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Krummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this assuming that multiple judgments is for the same parents?
Chair Williams, Representative Krummel, for the same non-custodial parent or the same obligor, yes. There would be different custodial parents on each of the cases and different children. They're individual family units that each have their own case set up through the child support program.
Okay, that's what I wanted to just clarify. So it could be a father that has had several partners and several children.
Chair Williams, Representative Krummel, that is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Well, again, just I'm trying to get the practicalities of it. Then, for instance, in the sentence on line 14, the writ also. Oh, let me see. Line 13, the writ must reflect the captions of all cases for which the writ is issued. You're going to have different case numbers. How will the courts process that? Will they get one document with three different case names and case numbers in that?
Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, yes, we've talked about the best way to do that and the least amount of paperwork that we will need to work out in implementation, but we do need to reflect all of the various captions so that should a challenge of garnishment, we do not file administrative garnishments in court up front. We wait, and if there's a challenge of garnishment, then we forward a file. So we want to make sure that those files can be identified depending on the county that obligor chooses to file in.
Yes, follow-up.
Question, you're sure you can do this without changing the statutory form?
Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, I believe that with regard to the administrative child support garnishments, we got some flexibility language that said in substantially the same form, so we have a little bit of leeway when we're issuing these because our cases have special needs.
Representative Ackerman.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will follow Representative Shetterly into the valley and try this.
Careful, they're still getting out.
Again, a practicality question. If the department shall adopt rules regarding the distribution of, the proceeds to the judgment creditors, how then do the individual judgments get satisfied?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, that references to basically existing rules that we have in place for the distribution of child support, and briefly the way that child support is distributed from most collection activities today is first we're going to attempt to fulfill the monthly obligation on each of those cases. Then if there are still funds available, we will start to apply them to arrears owed to families, and last we will apply it to debts owed to the state. So depending on how long those funds last and those individual calculations, those are the types of distribution schemes that we would be looking at. So in some scenarios, depending on the size of the asset that we garnish, we may be only making a dent towards satisfying those obligations. And in other large garnishments, we may be able to satisfy several cases.
Well, is there something, I'm thinking of a scenario other than administrative proceeding. Well, administrative proceeding, the judgment is docketed anyway in circuit court as a judgment, and I'm still not satisfied that you complete the process unless your rulemaking provides some mechanism to satisfy the individual judgments after you've allocated them between creditors.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, if I understand correctly where you're heading, number one, that scenario is going to be pretty rare. We'd have to be looking at, for example, a case where there's no longer a monthly obligation, simply arrears on a case that we're attempting to collect. And it is true in that scenario, should the garnishment completely pay or satisfy that debt, and we're at the end of our enforcement services at that point, we file with the circuit court in order to show that that judgment is satisfied. But for most of these cases, we've got an ongoing obligation, and it's an ongoing enforcement tool. So we're not completely satisfying a court file, so to speak, but it's a partial satisfaction, a partial payment towards the debt.
Well, we'll discuss this later. I'm not quite clear, but if the creditor community is satisfied, I certainly am, but I'm I'm worried about how these monies get collected and how they get back to the court file to show the judgment was satisfied in some respect.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, briefly, we keep the complete accounting records on child support in our system, our automated system, and that is where other collectors, debtors, mortgage companies, and so on check the record to see the current status. It's not till the end of the life of a case that we then complete that court file and file that documentation. Since all payments are made through the statewide disbursement unit, which is part of the program, and payments are not ever made through the courthouse any longer, we keep the record until such time that that judgment is over. And that's when we clear that file.
But something will be placed in the court file. Is that the bottom line?
That is the bottom line. That is correct.
Thank you. Yeah,
eventually there is a satisfaction which issues. Anything else, colleagues? This is scintillating. Representative McPherson, I couldn't tell if you were just smiling at me or you were signaling me to that you got a question.
Question for Ms. Schenkel. Is the ordering rule that you described where the amounts collected are allocated first to new to current obligations, then to arrearages, and then to for reimbursement of the state. Is that set out in statute, or is that just a matter of the rules that are referred to here?
Chair Williams and Representative McPherson, the statute refers to the fact that we must, the child support program in Oregon must abide by our federal regulations for child support distribution. That's found in Chapter 25, and I could get the exact site for you. And then it further says that the department shall have rulemaking to reflect those federal guidelines. And then specifically our distribution rule, it's found in Administrative Rule in 461-200-6020. And that basically is a mirror of our current federal regulation.
Right. So I'm understanding that it is a federal requirement that we follow that ordering rule.
Chair Williams and Representative McPherson, that is correct. There is a federal requirement that there is a certain pattern of events that we use for distribution that all states must follow.
Your colleagues, you'll find that much in this particular area of support enforcement is mandated on us by federal law, and it's we spend a great deal of time, as you can tell, ensuring that our state laws comport to federal requirements because it affects many other things that the federal government does for us and to us. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I just had a question, I guess, more as to practice than to the bill. But I hear you say, Ronell, that you've got this judgment for past due support. You receive payments on that, and when the judgment is fully paid, you file a satisfaction. So you don't file partial satisfactions as payments are received?
Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, that is correct. We do not have the resource ability to be filing on our caseload every month on all of the payments made. So we maintain complete accounting records and try to make those as available as we can with a quick turnaround to anyone who needs the information.
And I've noticed with this great interest in the garnishment issue, yeah. I am just absolutely excited about when the garnishment bill comes before the committee in a week or two, your active participation. Anyone who would like to work on the Law Commission work group, I see lots of potential volunteers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ackerman and then Representative Pazanski.
Well, I'm back in the valley with Representative Shetterly.
I'm out of the valley.
Well, I'm alone then. I did not understand that you would not file partial satisfactions. If that was your response to Representative Shirley's question, there's inherent unfairness to the debtor here because his record or her record would show an unpaid judgment or a partially unpaid judgment when in fact it was. And that could impair that person's credit. It could certainly impair that, be a cloud on a person's title, the judgment lien. I find that's rather unfair. You can keep the money, take responsibility for collecting it, don't take responsibility for satisfying the judgment. If I was a lawyer doing this on the collection side, that would be one of my obligations.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, upon request, of course, and specifically we have a group of people called the Title Escrow Assistance Desk. We will file documents that basically bring that court file up to date with regard to the payments we have received and distributed, but it is correct that the program does not have the ability on our cases to file partial satisfactions every month that we receive payments, and in fact, on many cases, because of income withholding, we receive multiple payments in a month. We simply cannot file that that quantity of paperwork on a regular basis, and I doubt that the courts would even be able to get them into the file should we do so. So in reverse, or in place of that, we have tried to be very cognizant of customer service in making records available to the parties or to their attorneys or to the mortgage companies on our complete accounting records at any time they need them. In fact, we are heading towards having that information available over the Internet in the future so that they could immediately access it even if our office was not open.
I understand your position.
Okay, colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2114, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2114. And given the small nature of this amendment, colleagues, we're going to try to do this on the fly and operate without a net. So the chair would move for temporary suspension of the rules in order to consider a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2114. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, if I could say, for the record, it is before us in writing. It's just not an LC form.
It's just not an LC form. That's right. So we now have temporarily suspended the rules for purposes of consideration of a conceptual amendment. The chair would move a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2114, striking the word immediately from line 18 and capitalizing the U in the word upon. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the conceptual amendment? Hearing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move House Bill 2114 as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2114 as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
I'm going to oppose for the reasons I previously stated. I think this is unfair for the creditors to have the benefit of the garnishment proceeding and not have the responsibility for filing partial satisfactions in the court file. I think this does a reasonable disruption to debtors, and that those that collect the money should have the responsibility for entering satisfactions to correct the record.
Representative Ackerman, if I might, and I certainly understand the issue that you raised, I'm wondering, and I'm not meaning to talk you out of a no vote particularly on this bill. I guess my suggestion to you is that the merger of this bill into the single writ doesn't necessarily change what is current practice with respect to the program's non-filing on those satisfactions. And I guess what I'd recommend is if you can see your way clear to support the single writ concept, which I think is a positive concept for administrative purposes, we might have another opportunity down the road or in discussions with the program or, frankly, under your own desire to perhaps sponsor a separate piece of legislation with respect to garnishment, if that's what you saw fit to do, as a way to do that. I certainly, again, don't want to talk you out of a no vote on the bill if that's where you want to go with it. I certainly understand what you've just identified as a concern to you. I'm just not sure voting no on this particular bill, which merges the writ, is necessarily... it would send the signal that you oppose the merger of the writ when I think your concerns are of a broader nature that affect the entire program. But I'm happy to entertain a discussion with you about that, but you're certainly welcome to take the position whichever
you
think.
Well, no, I'm objecting to the rules process, which allows the distribution of money to the judgment creditors, and this is new law, without the commensurate responsibility of filing his partial satisfaction.
Okay. All right, I understand that. Then why don't we go ahead and call the roll, showing Representative Jensen is excused.
Jefferson Parker?
Aye.
Representative Cummell?
Aye.
Representative Gibson?
Aye.
Representative Podesky?
Aye.
Representative
Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
No.
Chair Williams?
Aye.
House Bill 2114 is conceptually amended, is passed, and we'll send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer carrier on this one? Come on, nothing. It never gets better than garnishment support enforcement on the floor. Come on.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'll carry it if you'd like, unless you want to give it to the freshman.
Well, Representative Anderson volunteer. Representative Barker's got one. We'll give one to Representative Anderson then.
Oh, that's good.
All right.
Mr. Chair, before we close.
Representative Przanski.
I just want to ask the chair to take note for the record that during this
lively debate on garnishments, it was to your right side, the dais, as compared to your left side, that was in the valley, that wanted to have the discussion, and should be on the subcommittee up on the hill.
Yeah, this was the valley side all the way here. You're right. All four of them, in fact. My gosh. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, and we'll adjourn.
Together. Protect us.